This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The White House announced today that Israel agreed to daily four-hour pauses of military operations in Gaza to allow for civilians to leave the area and humanitarian aid to come in. This comes after a week of debate about how to de-escalate the war, with the Biden administration supporting what are called humanitarian pauses. Here's U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken speaking at a press conference yesterday.
We had in-depth discussions about the steps that we are taking to address urgent needs on the ground. We all agreed that humanitarian pauses would advance key objectives to protect Palestinian civilians, to increase the sustained flow of humanitarian assistance, to allow our citizens and foreign nationals to exit, and to facilitate the release of hostages. I briefed my colleagues about my conversations with Israeli leaders on pauses and on concrete steps to minimize harm to Palestinian civilians in Gaza and to stop extremist violence in the West Bank.
The Biden administration hasn't pursued a ceasefire, but the United Nations, many world leaders, peace activists, and policy experts are urging that the fighting stop altogether. Our next guest has joined the call for an immediate ceasefire. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with the Biden administration's support of this idea of humanitarian pauses in the conflict? Do you think the situation calls for a ceasefire? Do you have questions for our guest about what the difference is and about some of the deeper issues underlying the conflict? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Phyllis Bennis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where she directs the New Internationalism Project, focusing on the Middle East, U.S. militarism, and U.N. issues. She's the author or editor of 11 books, including Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, and serves as the international advisor to Jewish Voice for Peace. Phyllis, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be with you.
Now, first of all, what's your reaction today to this, at least, announcement from the White House about Israel agreeing to temporary humanitarian pauses? I understand we haven't heard a confirmation of that from Israeli leaders?
We have not heard a confirmation, and we haven't seen any halt in the bombing. The humanitarian need on the ground, the urgent need, is to stop the bombing. The idea of a humanitarian pause is better than not having it for, they're talking about 1 or 2 hours, maybe 3 hours. But the reality is that it's not enough, and as soon as that pause ends, the bombing resumes and the killing resumes. So we're now seeing, according to Save the Children, one child is killed by Israeli bombing every 10 minutes. Every 10 minutes. So will this mean that they're only being killed every 11 minutes? If so, that's not good enough. That's not good enough. That's why we're needing a ceasefire that stops the bombing, period, full stop. And let's be clear, we're talking about a bilateral ceasefire. So that means Hamas also stops sending these rockets of various sorts into Israel. Luckily, none of them are hitting anything. Nobody has been killed by them, luckily. But they are still illegal, and they should be stopped as well. But the bombs that are killing people are the Israeli bombs, and they need to stop.
The argument from Israel is that a ceasefire would help Hamas regroup and maybe renew terrorist attacks on Israel itself. What are your thoughts on, first of all, Israeli resistance to the idea of a ceasefire?
You know, this notion that a ceasefire only helps Hamas really sort of begs the question of, what do you think about how much it helps the children of Gaza who might get to live? You know, nobody ever talks about that. It's always, well, will it help Hamas more or will it help Israel more? It's going right to the question of what happens to the fighters, not what happens to the victims, to the people who are doing the dying. That's why we say that there's a need for a ceasefire. That's why the Pope called for a ceasefire. That's why the Secretary General of the United Nations is calling for a ceasefire. That's why governments around the world, not only in the Global South, although clearly more strongly there, today even President Macron in France announced his support for a ceasefire. The U.S. is increasingly isolated on this question. And, you know, we should be clear about this question of what's the role of the U.S. We've been hearing, there was a big piece in the New York Times today, another one in the Washington Post, about how the Biden administration and Biden himself are upset about the lack of Israeli collaboration with what the U.S. is requesting. And I'm sitting there thinking, Why should they collaborate? Why should they agree? Because all the U.S. is doing is issuing very polite, mild requests. Please stop bombing. And Netanyahu says, no. And then the answer is, okay, and we'll go on to talk about something else. They're not going to stop the bombing. They're not going to issue a ceasefire. They don't want to, clearly. But part of it is the U.S. is not imposing any consequences for their refusal. So if Biden went to Israel or called him on the phone and said, hey, Bibi, you got to stop the bombing. You got to stop the killing. And Netanyahu said, no. Then the answer is, okay, you're supposed to be an independent country. You can do what you want. But you know the rest of that $4 billion that we send you every year, that some of it's still in the pipeline, the weapons and the cash, you can kiss that goodbye. And you know the other $14 billion we're trying to get Congress to agree to send to you? That's not going to happen. And you know how we've always protected you so that you're never held accountable at the International Criminal Court for the actions that you're taking that violate all kinds of international law, from the Geneva Conventions to the Convention Against Genocide? We're not going to protect you anymore. I think we'd start to see a very different answer from the Israelis very quickly.
Talking to Phyllis Bennis with the Institute for Policy Studies about calls for a ceasefire in Gaza. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Phyllis, you've written recently about what you hope would come after a ceasefire, and that you say is a look at some of the underlying causes, the long-running causes of these conflicts in the first place. What kind of things would you like to see the U.S. talking about, the international community talking about, and of course, Israelis and Palestinians talking about?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that. It's very difficult to talk these days about root causes, because the idea of talking about root causes is somehow being equated to giving credence or even supporting the horrific acts that Hamas carried out on October 7th, as if understanding why things happen is the same thing as supporting them or something. The reality is our understanding of history always starts with when you start the clock. If you start the clock on October 7th, you see as your first thing these horrific attacks from Hamas against 1,400 people who were killed, about 335 of whom were military. The rest were civilians, mostly Israelis, not all, a lot of internationals as well. And you don't ever get to see why something like that would happen. If you don't understand why it happened, it's almost impossible to imagine what it would take to make it stop, to make sure it never happens again. So if you don't understand that the horrific violence that we saw explode on October 7th didn't, as Secretary General of the UN, Guterres put it, it didn't happen in a vacuum. It was rooted in decades of occupation, 16 years of a brutal siege of Gaza, collective punishment, all kinds of violations of international law and the laws of war. You know, this is now the sixth attack. It's of a whole different scale. It's hugely more punishing, killing far more people and lasting longer than earlier Israeli assaults on Gaza. But those assaults are not new. The first one was in 2008 and 9, what was called Operation Cast Lead. And then there was another in 2012 and another very big one in 2014 that left 2,200 Palestinians dead. There was another one in 2018. And then there was another in 2021, just a couple of years ago. We didn't hear this kind of outrage when Palestinians were attacked with Israeli initiative, without any claim that something right then had happened that required it. The Israeli position, still until now, as far as I know, but what they always used to talk about at the official level, this is not just some media headline, but in the Knesset, this is called mowing the grass. It was the notion that every couple of years, you have to remind the people of Gaza who's really in control. And you do that by bombing. You do that by imposing an even more crippling siege. You know, one of the things that I hadn't known about the siege of Gaza that began in 2007, it's been a siege now for more than 16 years. And we're hearing now about this brutal siege that has cut off all access to food, water, fuel, electricity, all the things that make life possible in this isolated area. But the siege that's been underway now for 16 years, one of the impacts of it that I had never known, I thought I knew a lot about the impact, the humanitarian impact of the siege, but I didn't know this. It turns out that as of January of this year, way before this current crisis, the siege impact was so bad that 20% of the children of Gaza were stunted before the age of 2, because there simply is not sufficient good food. None of it had protein. They had no access to fresh vegetables, no access to fruit. Often milk was in short supply and baby formula. And the result was 20%, one out of every 5 babies, was stunted in Gaza for the last 16 years. And this is one of those stunning factoids that you never think about until suddenly you do. And you realize how devastating that is for a whole generation of people who are going to grow up in Gaza, those who survive this. We now know from Save the Children that one child is dying every 10 minutes under the bombs. This is the impact of the siege that's been underway since 2007, 16 years. Imagine how many children have now been affected by that.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Robert is with us in Appleton. Robert, hi.
Yeah, you know, nobody supports what Hamas did. They went out across the border with the intention of committing horrible atrocities, and they certainly did. However, you also have to acknowledge the reality that one of the reasons why there's this siege that is stunting children is that Hamas has always, since the day they took over in Gaza, said they're committed to the entire destruction of the state of Israel and the death of every Israeli citizen. You also have to keep in mind that Hamas has put legitimate military targets where they will do the absolute most damage to civilians, underneath hospitals, underneath refugee camps. Hamas has fired on Israeli troops that were trying to clear a path to help the people in Gaza to get out to Egypt. And let's be clear, nobody has clean hands in this conflict. 3 of the prime ministers of Israel were members of the Irgun gang, who carried out atrocities and human rights offenses that are right up there with anything that the Palestinians have ever done. They blew up the King David Hotel full of British soldiers who were there in a hospital.
Robert, thanks for the call, Phyllis.
Robert is absolutely right. And we can look at just a few days ago when the current president of Israel, Bibi Netanyahu, called for a holy war against Gaza. And he based it on the biblical story of the Israelites being ordered by God to annihilate the Amaleks for revenge, for vengeance, not for justice, for vengeance. You know, these stories that you can find arguments for whatever you want in the Bible. I guess that's true. I'm not a biblical scholar, but I know a little bit. And I heard about this one, and then I followed up on it to see what he actually said. And yeah, the story of the Amaleks reminded me of our own country, where you had, during what were known as the Indian Wars in the 19th century, many of them, the generals, many of them were ministers. And they were the ones who used the language about killing children. And in one example, in the Sand Creek Massacre, the general ordered his troops to attack a peaceful sleeping village of indigenous people on the banks of a river. And some of his own soldiers came and said, wait, these are children. These are babies and women. And he said, kill them all. Nits make lice. And that became the theme song, the meme, if you will, 200 years ago, of what these wars were about, killing the children because they would grow up to be the people we wanted to get rid of. And this is the same thing we're seeing now. And yes, it goes back to the early founding of the Zionist movement. There's a long history of Zionist terror that was crucial in creating the state of Israel, in expelling the 750,000 Palestinians who were kicked out. And yes, what Hamas is doing, as I said right at the beginning, maybe you missed it, Robert, is that what Hamas did on October 7th was in complete violation of international law, and they should be held accountable. What international law does not allow is two things in this case. One is no one who's carrying out a war, including a war that might be legal, no one is allowed to attack civilians, to issue collective punishment in its war, to refuse to distinguish between civilian and military targets, all of which Israel is doing right now. And on the other hand, what Hamas did also targeted both military and civilian targets. The majority of the people who were killed were indeed civilians. That is also illegal. There is a difference. Both sides are prohibited from attacking civilians. Period. Full stop.
Thanks for the call, Robert. Phyllis Bennis is with us at the Institute for Policy Studies, looking at the Israel-Hamas war in Gaza. She's calling for a ceasefire there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Phyllis Bennis from the Institute for Policy Studies, looking at Israel, Hamas, and Gaza, the Biden administration's Middle East policy, and increasing calls for a ceasefire. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Matt is with us in Middleton. Matt, hi.
Hello. Kind of following up on what Rob said previously, I don't think there's going to be any end to this tit for tat until, as Israel said, Hamas is gone. And what does that mean? To me, that means that the entire Gaza Strip is occupied by Israel, the government's replaced, and the Gaza Strip becomes either a province that either is self-governing or has an oversight to it until such time as terrorist organizations aren't being elected by the people. We did the same thing during World War II when Germany was conquered. We replaced the government with one that was drawn up by the Allies. There was a government that was voted on, and there was supervision for the next two or three decades.
Matt, thanks for the call. To clarify, Rob, he was talking about Rob the caller, not Rob the host. Phyllis, your thoughts on Matt's idea there.
Yeah, I suppose that Matt was also a fan of the Iraq War, because that's just what we did there, too. And how'd that go for us? You know, we overthrew the government, dismantled the army, and imposed a government that we thought was going to be democratic. And then we even went through the motions of having democracy. For 20 years, we were at war. I don't think that's going to work. I think that what we need is a ceasefire to stop the violence and then look at the root causes, which have to do with the longstanding occupation and theft of land, which has characterized the relationship between Israel and the Palestinians since 1947-48. I think that what the Biden administration is doing region-wide right now, sending a nuclear-powered and a nuclear-capable, nuclear-weapons-capable submarine to the region, sending two aircraft carrier groups with hundreds, it means about 150 warplanes, another 1,000 troops, bringing to a total of 45,000 U.S. troops in the region, special forces that were just sent in. That's not going to reduce regional tensions, which is what we're being told. It's going to ratchet up the regional tensions. That's why we need a ceasefire.
Thanks for the call. Jan joins us now in Wisconsin. Jan, hi. Are you there, Jan? Not hearing Jan, but Jan was wondering about what's going on in the West Bank with a lot of focus on Gaza. There is also violence in the West Bank. What are you watching for there, Phyllis?
Yeah, the level of violence has escalated massively in the last year, and especially in this last month when, as you say, all eyes have been on Gaza. The far-right extremist government that the Israelis elected, we're talking about elections here, that they elected, have, among other things, brought the majority of the Israeli soldiers, including those that had been deployed around the Gaza Strip, to the West Bank to protect settlers while they carry out what amount to pogroms against Palestinian cities and towns and villages. Two more Bedouin villages have just had their whole set of homes destroyed and their villages ended, essentially just wiped out in settler attacks. There was another attack today in Jenin refugee camp that left 10 Palestinians dead. I don't know how many were injured. I just got the news a couple of hours ago. So the level of violence, the olive trees that are being uprooted, Palestinians being arrested in huge numbers, there's now an additional 5,000 Palestinians that have been arrested just this month from the West Bank and are being held almost entirely on the basis of what they call administrative detention in military prisons, where they can be held for 6 months without any charges being filed, without having the right to see their charges, because there are none, with their lawyers having no information about why they're being held. And when the 6 months is up, they can be held for another 6 months, and that can go on, as it is going on in some cases, for years. And of those 1,200 or so administrative detention prisoners, 120 of them are children, because only Israel has a juvenile military detention system. It's the only country in the world that brings children as young as 12. That's when it starts in the West Bank, when you become eligible to be arrested by the military, held and interrogated by the military, imprisoned by the military, and then sentenced by a military judge for a 12-year-old child. Imagine that. So that's what we're looking at right now in the West Bank. And that situation is absolutely explosive. More than 130 Palestinians, that was before the 10 today, so it's now at least 140 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank in this last month. So the situation there is very, very dangerous for Palestinians, increasingly so.
Phyllis, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where she directs the New Internationalism Project. She's the author of several books, including Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, serves as the international advisor to Jewish Voice for Peace. She joined us for a look at what's happening in the Israel-Hamas war, including today's announcement that Israel has agreed to humanitarian pauses, that announcement from the White House, why she and others are calling for a ceasefire. You can follow the various conversations we've had about Gaza here on the Ideas Network and NPR coverage over at WPR.org.